Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm Mark Locks, the host, and today I'm very pleased to have Mark Mazzetti on the line from Washington, D.C., and we're going to talk about his new book, The Way of the Knife. And this book actually came out, I believe, last year. Is that correct, Mark?
That's right. It was in the spring of 2013.
Yes. I actually read it. I grabbed it at an airport and saw it as a normal airport book and read it and was very impressed and thought I'd have to get you online. It's taken a while to get you. I actually bought it last November on a way to America, but I was very, very impressed with the book, and it was certainly a topic that I thought I knew something about, and it turned out I didn't. But thank you very much for participating today, Mark.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
That's all right. We'll start off, as I said in the pre-interview, with a bit of a background to you and how you came to write this book. And I have to note for the listeners that you are a Pulitzer Prize winner, the very first one I've ever spoken to.
Well, I'm sure it won't be the last.
I hope not. So how did you come to what's your background and how did you come to write this particular book?
So I've been covering national security issues since 2001, actually, about 6 months before the September 11th attacks, and covering it from different sides. I was covering the military and the Pentagon for about 5 years, and then for the New York Times, starting in 2006, focused more on intelligence, the intelligence community, more specifically the CIA. And what I really became to be interested in, I covered the war in Afghanistan, and I went there, and I covered Iraq, and I went there. But really what interested me most was what I call the shadow war, which is the war outside of the declared war zones of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I sort of came to think that so much of the history of this post 9/11 period actually happened outside of Iraq and Afghanistan. So what I set out to do is to try to tell as much of a history as can be told now about what happened outside of Iraq and Afghanistan in the shadow war, and how it came to sort of become a model for how war will be waged in the future.
Yeah. And now the book itself actually has, I would call them, two protagonists, one being the CIA and the other being the more mainstream military. And the surprise that I found in reading the book was that the classic movie version of the CIA didn't appear to have existed. And if anything, your book is more or less presenting the modern military as taking on the role of the stylized or mythical version of the CIA. Would that be a quick summary of?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way to look at it. The real shorthand version that I use is that, in the last 12 years, the CIA's come to look a lot more like the military, and the military's come to look a lot more like the CIA.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is this. When you say the sort of Hollywood stylized version, people think of the CIA as, Jason Bourne assassins. And really, that – if that ever existed, it didn't exist for decades. And what I try to do is go back to the history, through the history of the CIA, to sort of chart its various phases. And the period from the 1970s, when for those who your listeners who aren't aware of the history, of the Church Committee, which was a Senate investigation of CIA activities. In the 1970s, the CIA, all of their sort of dirty laundry of the early decades of its existence was aired out. And from the 1970s, from when President Ford signed a ban on assassinations, until 9/11, the CIA was kind of out of the killing business. They really didn't have the authority to go out and just, kill America's enemies around the world. And so and that really shaped the CIA as an organization. And then post 9/11 has been this dramatic transformation into this manhunting paramilitary organization. On the flip side, if you look at the military and the Pentagon, when I say they become more like the CIA, you've seen this dramatic expansion of the military in the last 12 years into places where soldiers didn't used to go, into places like Pakistan, places in Africa, places that weren't declared war zones, and in many ways still aren't. But they have been sent there because the Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary at the time, said, this is a global war, and I'm the commander of war, and I need to send my soldiers where the war is.
Right. So let's get a picture then of what the modern CIA is doing. Since it's not this Hollywood version, what does the CIA do? What's its role? And what role specifically does it play in the post-9/11 world?
Well, I think it's probably, you know, a little bit closer to the Hollywood stylized version than it certainly was on 9/11, in the sense that the CIA now has this lethal authority to go around the world and kill people. Now, what does that usually mean? It mostly manifests in attacks by armed drones, where you have the in Pakistan and Yemen or parts of Africa, the CIA targeting people and killing them. That is, you know, this extraordinary development that's happened in the last, you know, decade, where the CIA goes out and does it so often that it's become very routine. But you know, it really matters to go back and look at the history, because I spent a chapter in the book tracing the arc of the armed predator and how the CIA came to finally adopt the predator. And this wasn't really an easy call. In the months before the September 11th attacks, the CIA was debating whether they should, you know, go take the armed predator and kill Osama bin Laden. But there was a big fight over it, because they didn't want to get back into the assassination business. As I said, they'd gotten out of that business in the 70s. So then 9/11 happens, and they, you know, go back with this lethal authority. You know, some of those debates they had months earlier, you know, seemed kind of quaint, but now they do it so routinely that it's easy to forget that this was a big step for the agency.
That's right. So how broad is their operation? So are they running the drone program just across the Middle East or anywhere else in the world?
Well, it's a good question, because it is sort of country specific, and sometimes as a reporter, it's hard to figure out who's running what. And this gets to this old issue we discussed earlier about the blurring of the lines between the CIA and the Pentagon. So right now, the CIA runs the drone program in Pakistan. That's the kind of longest standing drone war. It was started in 2004. Pakistan wasn't the first drone strike outside of a declared war zone. That happened in Yemen in 2002. But by far, the real laboratory for the drone war has been in Pakistan, and the CIA still runs that. In other countries, though, the Pentagon runs it, not only in Afghanistan, but in Somalia, the Pentagon is in charge of that. In Yemen, and this is kind of the most interesting case, in Yemen, you have two parallel drone wars being run. You have the CIA drone war and you have the military drone war. They both take strikes, and it's very hard as an outsider to know kind of who does what and why. And we're still trying to sort through these things. Last May, President Obama gave a big speech about how he was going to be more transparent about drone operations, but you know, that's still yet to come.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people refer to this drone strikes as the extrajudicial killings. And what is this process that either the CIA or the military go through when they make a decision that they're going to do a drone strike? And are there two very, very distinct processes they have to go through?
It's a good question that we're still trying to get all the details about. I mean, certainly the CIA has been doing this longer than the military has, which sounds kind of strange, but the CIA has been doing this, you know, intelligence gathering and trigger pulling with armed predators for really longer than the military has. So the CIA has a system developed where, you know, first of all, they have to get the intelligence. And, you know, so much is focused on the actual trigger pulling, the actual armed drone strike. But that's really maybe only 1 or 2% of it, right? Most of what goes into a drone strike is the intelligence gathering leading up to that strike, and then the decision making about whether to take the shot. So first of all, it's a question of, do you have any intelligence on the ground to feed into these drone strikes. And then once you have a pretty good sense of who the person is that you want to go after and you know where they are, then the decision has to be made, do you take the shot? And one of the interesting things about the history of the drone program over the last 10 years, if you just look in Pakistan, and it's really just been a decade, it was June 2004 was the first drone strike in Pakistan, was that the strikes were, in the first few years, were very infrequent and they were very inaccurate. They took shots maybe 3 or 4 a year, if that, and very often they missed. And that was not a technology issue, really. It was mostly an intelligence issue. They had very bad intelligence about where people were. And so they killed civilians, and they sometimes were aiming at the right person, but their intelligence was maybe 2 or 3 hours behind. And so that led to some of these botched drone strikes.
Right. Let's take a step back then and go back to the military side. How did the military end up carrying out these sort of operations, and what drove them to do it?
So if we backed up to the birth of the armed Predator, the CIA had used the Predator in the 90s in the Balkans, and then it was, but it was effectively run by the military. It was an Air Force operation. And when the birth of the armed Predator, when they actually put a missile on it, the Air Force did it, as I recount in the book. There was a lot of testing in the deserts of Nevada and California, but they were mostly doing it for the CIA. And so the CIA took over this operation, and first in Afghanistan and then Yemen and Pakistan. But the military realized early on that they could use this quite effectively in the, you know, overt declared wars that it was waging, Afghanistan and Iraq. So the military has used this extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan, more than, you know, overall more than the CIA has. We pay attention to the CIA doing it because it's done in places that aren't in declared war zones, right? So Pakistan and, you know, other places. But, you know, the military, you know, in the height of the Iraq war was doing drone strikes in Iraq all the time. So these are, and it's just like any kind of weapon. Instead of using a jet fighter to drop bombs, the Air Force uses an armed drone. And so that is something that I think sometimes gets lost because the media doesn't cover it, because it's just and from my own point of view, I'm more interested in the sort of authorities that lead someone to do these operations than the actual technology itself, because I think in many ways an armed drone is no different than a rifle or a jet fighter.
You're right. Go.
And so that's where, you know, but I think we're in an age where you know, that's going to change, where more and more countries are developing the technology, and so they're going to start using them by the same authorities that the United States has for some time, and that's where it's going to get interesting, right? When the Russians decide to use a drone outside of its, you know, outside of their borders against terrorist suspects who they say they're killing in self-defense. I mean, that's the same justification the United States has been using. And that's when it's going to become very sort of dicey for the United States to make a case against that.
Yeah. So who are the people who are being killed by the drones? So we basically talked about, one, the military using it as a military tool, as you say, just as any other weapon. Is there a differentiation of the type of targets that the CIA are attacking? Are they choosing more political rather than military targets?
They have to target individuals who are sort of broadly part of militant groups, either, you know, bent on attacking the United States or America's allies, or attacking American troops in Afghanistan. Now, so that's a pretty broad definition. And so they don't necessarily have to go after Al-Qaeda or someone who is trying to attack the United States. They can do strikes against groups in Pakistan who might be plotting attacks against American troops in Afghanistan. And that's where the bar got lowered to some degree. And you have what are called signature strikes, which are strikes where the CIA doesn't even have to know specifically the identity or identities of the people they're going after. There's something called personality strikes, which are, we know this specific person, we know where he is, we know he's a Al-Qaeda leader, and we're going to kill him. Signature strikes are broader, and there's a lower standard to meet. There's a group of people in Pakistan that we believe are being trained to go over the border to attack American troops in Afghanistan. We don't know exactly who they are, but intelligence suggests that they are going to launch an attack. So therefore, we have the authority, we being the CIA, have the authority to go kill them. Now, those are more controversial because, again, the threshold is lower. They don't even exactly know who they're killing. And there's also been instances where there's been, a lot of civilians killed in these signature strikes because the intelligence has been bad. They think that there's a group of people massing to carry out an attack, and it's ended up being a tribal meeting in Pakistan. So, in some ways, that's a more controversial call. But Obama last year in his speech said, at least as long as American troops are in Afghanistan, he's going to allow these kind of strikes in Pakistan.
Yeah, I've seen stories on CNN about, claims that American strikes are being carried out on behalf of the Pakistan Intelligence Service or the Pakistan Army as well. So, like, complementary strikes will give you permission to have strikes inside Pakistan if you also add some of our targets onto your list.
Yeah, the shorthand sort of jargon is goodwill kills. That you have two allies who don't trust each other, but you build up goodwill by killing each other's enemies. And if you look back, as I do in the book, in the first drone strike in Pakistan, many ways was such a goodwill kill. There was a guy named Nek Mohammed who was a tribal leader who had raised an insurgency in Pakistan, really going after Pakistani troops. He wasn't a senior Al-Qaeda leader, but he kept defeating Musharraf's government troops in Pakistan. And Musharraf got so angry that this guy kept making ceasefires and then breaking them and really humiliating Pakistani troops, that he gave the authority to the CIA to go kill him. And that was the beginning, and that was kind of what set this very strange and in some ways cynical history in motion, where from the very beginning, the CIA had the authority to do these strikes, but all along, both sides denied that they were doing it. And, I do think that there's a great deal of anger towards drone strikes, not only in Pakistan, but within the Pakistani government. But at the same time, the Pakistani government, if they had wanted to, could have shut this program down, and they haven't.
Right. It's a strange mechanism, too, because obviously it gives you a great deal of opportunities you could never otherwise had. Do you think they would have carried out these same sorts of strikes had they involved flying piloted planes across into Pakistan?
No, I mean, that's a great question because in many ways the technology allows you to do things you never would have risked doing before. And I guess it's seductive in a way where the easier it becomes to do something, the more often you do it. Right. I mean, the government of Pakistan from the get-go always said, we won't allow American troops in Pakistan. And as I recount in the book, that line has been pushed on several occasions, most notably was the Bin Laden raid. But this was a way around that. It was a way to, kill America's enemies and get away with saying we're not going to put the military in there. And if there was a drone shot down, you wouldn't lose a pilot. And so there's low risk.
Yeah. So I see some similarities to the whole war in the Balkans in the 90s, where people preferred bombing over putting troops on the ground because of all the problems that involved. And then this raises it up, as you say, to another level of political security again, where there are no body bags at all. It's risking mechanisms and robots rather than human beings.
Yeah, and I think that so this is just extending it a little bit further. I mean, I think we should always be careful to say, what's revolutionary here. I mean, it's not revolutionary that there are weapons that go long distances without people involved, right? There's Tomahawk, there's cruise missiles, there's strikes where you can strike from afar without risking anything. I think what's interesting and most important about this period of time is the sort of determinations that this war would be around the world, and the United States can be justified in going to, into any one of these countries, not just a, with a one-off strike, but to send drones in and take strikes if they need to. And that sort of set, I think, the model for how things are going to go in the future when, you know, it's not just the United States doing it.
No. So when the military have access, or as they do, I should say, to these this mechanism, do they now have targets that they otherwise would not have attacked? So do they actually use this as an opportunity to carry out broader strategies that they otherwise wouldn't? And even do they actually contact the CIA and say, you know, given your range of powers in your jurisdiction, could you help us out by, for example, taking out a particular person?
Yeah, I mean, and there is that back and forth. So, for instance, the military still, you know, as I said, they've got their own drone program in Afghanistan, but they're still very hesitant to go over the border into Pakistan because of the legal justifications. And so they would, in that case, tell the CIA. And there was close coordination in that camp, in that, you know, the tribal areas of Pakistan, which the military is very concerned about because there have been guys going over the border into Afghanistan killing American troops. But the CIA runs that war, so there's a lot of back and forth there. You asked earlier about, you know, how is it different the way the CIA does it, the military does it. It's still an open question to me. For instance, you know, when I said that there's a drone program in, run by the military in Yemen, and there's a drone program run by the CIA in Yemen, what's very strange is that the CIA, the program, the drone strikes of the military in Yemen seem to be, go bad a lot more than the CIA do. There are more civilian casualties, there's botched operations. And, you know, on one hand, you'd say, well, aren't they all sharing the same intelligence? And aren't they basically the same weapons? But actually, as I dig into it, you learn it's not. They still hoard intelligence. They hoard sources. I think the Pentagon takes shots based on less information. And so it's really extraordinary to think that this goes on and that both sides still can't coordinate. So in some cases, there is good coordination. In other cases, there isn't.
Yeah, well, actually, that was leading to my next question, which was who actually in the military who owns the drones? Are they an Air Force asset? Are they an Army asset? Who do they belong to? Or do they all have their own?
The answer is they all have their own. Everyone's got drones now, and they all will. Some have very small drones, you know, like the drones you could basically fit in a pocket that are just used to, you know, you fly ahead of a tactical unit, you know, in an urban warfare setting and look around the corner to see what's there. But the drones that we mostly talk about are Predators and Reapers, which are the armed ones that take the shots. They are Air Force. They are Air Force weapons, but the Air Force then sends them to the theaters where they're being used, and then they're owned by whichever forward commander is in charge of them, whether it's Central Command, which controls the Middle East, African Command, which controls obviously Africa, their Special Operations Command. And so the drones are employed by all sorts of different military units. And it's only going to be getting, they're going to be proliferating even more. And then, you know, as I've talked to people, you know, Air Force people still hate the term drones. They're angry because there actually are still pilots that are flying these things. And there's actual pilots who sit in chairs, obviously not on the ground. They're not in cockpits. They sit in chairs and they fly them. And they hate the term drone because it implies that, you know, it's purely a robot. You program something to do a mission. But that is the direction we're going in. We're going into something where it's going to be purely drones. They are going to send drones on a mission without a pilot, program them to go, deliver a weapon, and then come back. We're not really there yet, but we will be in the future.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to get to a point where you allow the autonomy for the machine to even choose a target?
You know what? I think so. I mean, I think we're not a tech. I'm not a technologist, but the people who I do talk to say, sure, you know, you're going to have facial recognition software, which is programmed into, you know, the drone's, you know, technology, where they will look down on the ground and they have a face programmed in, and once they recognize the face, they'll take a shot. I mean, it's a scary thought, but I don't really think we're that far really in the future.
Yeah. No, no. Honestly, it reminds me of the last Captain America movie so much. So is there another layer of technology? We were talking about facial recognition, but is there another layer of the physical technology that's going to come? So is there a drone 2.0 that's going to add another level of resources to the military and to the CIA beyond just making them automatons? So is there some other mechanism, some other drone-type robot that they're going to that they're working on that's coming up on the books?
It's a good question. I don't know enough about what's on the cutting edge of the technology, other than to say that, you know, you talk to people and, I mean, there will be drones used for all sorts of things. It's not just combat. You will have drones that pick up soldiers on a battlefield, and they're programmed to take them back to a hospital. And you'll have drones that that do all manner of different military activities or intelligence gathering techniques. You know, it won't just be hovering over a compound in Pakistan and taking a shot. You will have, you know, small drones that are flying into a room and with a camera and being able to or a microphone and be able to listen to someone's conversation. And then, you know, the size of an insect. There's that type of technology. So this is all stuff that, again, it seems like science fiction, but I don't think we're that far away.
No.
Amazon is already announced they're going to deliver books by drones in the near future.
We have had some issues lately where private drone companies have been flying and ignoring the rules of air traffic control, where they've just flown wherever they felt like and across the landing paths of planes and so forth. So there's a lot that's going to be sorted out, I know, in Australia just on the civil drones program, let alone the military one. But that actually is important because, once again, I think the legal side of all these issues is even a decade behind the technology side. And I used to teach a course in military ethics, and I've never been able to get my head around where the drones fit into the ancient, I would say, military ethics and military law that's been around for like at least 100 years on how these decisions are made, who can be targeted where, who's allowed to be killed, and who is a combatant. How is that argument going in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, these are the arguments that I mean, the United States, we are still wrestling with this. I mean, this is still, you know, it's only been 10, 12 years where we've had to deal with this. And, you know, again, as you say, there is not there's precedent in history. Every time there's a new, you know, technology introduced, they say that it makes things unfair or it changes the laws of war. You know, the longbow in the Middle Ages, which allowed people to fire hundreds of yards away, seemed like it was a unchivalrous way to do battle because you didn't have to meet the person you were fighting or fight hand to hand. You know, there's advances in technology, and in many ways, drones are just another advance. But I do think that the way that, as you said, with the authorities, it's less the technology you use. It's whether, you know, you allow the American president to say, yes, this person in this far off land, in a country that's where the United States is allied with, that person can be killed. We now have the technology to reach out and, you know, kill people thousands of miles away with a very precise weapon. I mean, precise compared to carpet bombing or nuclear weapons, right? Nothing is entirely without risk. But and that's what we're wrestling with now is whether a president should have this authority and in what circumstances should he use it?
Yeah, yeah, because it raises those barriers of who are you at war with at any particular time and where does that executive versus congressional power, which is pretty much mirrored in most other Western countries as well. Where does the line get drawn and who are you allowed to, as we said before, have an extrajudicial killing of? I know that there were some issues about US citizens who'd been targets. And we've had a couple of Australian people who've been fighting in, well, members of ISIS, quite frankly, who've been killed in recent strikes. And what our role was, whether the Australian government was aware of this in advance and whether they'd authorised it. So I don't think this argument's going to go away, do you?
No. I mean, I think that, you know, your country, my country, all these, you know, countries have to, you know, it's a different type of warfare in the sense that it's intelligence driven. It's driven by, you know, it's not massed armies. Obviously, it's specific people inside countries. They might be citizens of any other country. And then once it's determined whose citizenship they have, then the question is, you know, can you kill them? And what right and by what authority you have to kill them? I mean, the United States, the first American that the United States knowingly went after and targeted and killed was Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in 2011. As I write about in the book, this was a really wrenching debate. At the same time, you know, Obama made it because he thought, you know, this person, and the legal justification was that this person had in a way forfeited his right to due process and therefore deserved to die. Now, 2 weeks later, again, going back to this, you know, parallel wars in the Pentagon and the CIA, 2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son was killed in Yemen by a military drone strike, and that was, by all accounts, not purposeful. It was accidental. But that was another American citizen, two American citizens killed within 2 weeks. One was on purpose and one was accidental. And this is the sort of – these are sort of these thresholds that we cross in this very new kind of war.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the interview today too. But can I ask a final question? Where do you think this is all going to be going as far as your own research? Do you think you're going to continue to pursue this? I expect you're going to get a lot of additional material coming in over the next decade at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's I remain very interested in these issues. Part of the problem with you know, this kind of history is still so much of it remains classified. So as things are declassified, you learn more. You know, given the CIA's track record, it could be 30, 40 years before the history of the last 10 years is declassified. So it's a long haul. But you know, as I said, it's so much of the history of this of the last 12 years is a secret history, and it's a classified history, but it remains important to cover. So I think that my fate is to continue trying to unearth some of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you very, very much for the interview today. Absolutely fascinating. I actually would recommend this book to anyone who, like me, has taught a subject of military ethics, because I think the students would not even know where to begin to solve some of the issues you raise in the book. So thank you very much.
And I hope students do keep debating this and discussing this, because I think it's going to be important for a while.
Great. Thank you. We've been talking to Mark Mazzetti about his new book, The Way of the Knife, A Recent History of Drone Strikes by Both the CIA and the American Military.